Steel Magnolias, and you're listening to Dave's Gone By on UNC Radio.
Welcome back to Dave's Gone By. Very excited to talk to a playwright that we have on the show this Saturday morning. And, you know, there's people have written thousands of plays in just the last few years. But if you think back over maybe the past 2.5 decades, the number of plays that have not just been successful, not just won Tony Awards or Drama Desk Awards or stuff like that, but if you think of plays that have crossed into the mainstream to the point that everybody knows them, whether they're theater goers or not, they're part of the lexicon of our culture. We don't have that many. We've got maybe Driving Miss Daisy is one of them. Crimes of the Heart, to some extent. Angels in America, but, you know, you ask anybody outside theater about Angels in America, and it really won't be too clear on what it is. But I'll betcha, you ask anybody about Steel Magnolias, and they will know, oh, yeah, it's these women in the beauty shop, and they're all bonding together in a tragedy, and da-da-da, because that play, Steel Magnolias, has come into our whole cultural consciousness. It's now 25 years old. In the intervening times from when it was first produced off-Broadway, it's had a very, very successful film, and now, most recently, a remake TV film. It's been revived on Broadway, and it has been done everywhere you can possibly think of. We did it at the University of Northern Colorado, where this program is coming from, just a year or so ago. But if you think Robert Harling, the author of Steel Magnolias, is a one-trick pony, oh, think again. Because Hollywood snapped him up, and he ended up writing screenplays for films like Soap Dish, and also, most recently, the television program GCB with Kristen Chenoweth was created by our guest, Robert Harling. And so, Mr. Harling, after that huge introduction, welcome to the neighborhood.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm exhausted.
Yeah, I do sometimes tend to run on in the intros, but I thought you deserved it.
No, I'm just thinking, wow, I've been busy, I guess.
Well, you certainly have, but I want to, first of all, disabuse people of the notion that you're just Steel Magnolias, you know, that you haven't done any other things. But why don't we get back to Steel Magnolias and tell people some more of the film work and the film script work that you've done over the years.
Okay.
Oh, I was going to let you do the honors.
While we were filming Steel Magnolias, I got the idea to do Soap Dish, which then starred Sally Field and Kevin Kline and Robert Downey Jr. And then after that, I did a film called First Wives Club. The First Wives Club.
Oh, which was a pretty big hit, as I recall.
Oh, yeah. I mean, people seem to really enjoy that one.
Now, let me ask, before we get on, as the writer of these movies, not the director, how much were you able to be on set and hobnob with the stars and also have input, or was it a case where you turned in your version of the script, three other people then worked on it, and you never saw it until you went to the theaters at its premiere?
It's a little bit of all of that. Steel Magnolias, I was very lucky. Well, it was filmed in my hometown. And it was filmed in the houses and the churches and the grocery stores where everything happened. And Ray Stark, the producer, and Herbert Ross, the director, were very interested in the reality and the veracity of everything as it is a totally true story. So they wanted me on the set. I wasn't on the set all the time. We spent all our time together because it was filmed in Natchitoches, Louisiana, my hometown, where I'm speaking to you from right now. Mm-hmm. And it was a situation where it wasn't like you're in Los Angeles and everyone finishes the day of shooting and they all go off to Spago or to their homes or families. There was really no place else to go other than to each other's houses, and we would have potluck suppers, and so it was like one big family for 3.5 months here. Soap Dish was a different situation. I came up with that. I was really busy working on some other things at the time, and so it was shot, and they did a wonderful job, and really, I wasn't around much there at all. First Wives Club, again, I was working on a version of the the Evening Star, which is I was directing that, which I had also written. It was a sequel for Terms of Endearment. So I was making my own film while First Wives Club was being filmed across the continent. So I didn't see much of that filming.
I'm a little curious how you got to be able to shoot Evening Star. I mean, had you done short films, commercials? Had you ever directed anything before then?
No, I hadn't, but I became very, very close friends with Shirley MacLaine during the filming of Steel Magnolias, and we had been looking for something to work together and work together on. And then when the novel, because Terms of Endearment was a novel by Larry McMurtry, when he wrote the sequel mm-hmm. to Terms of Endearment, which was called The Evening Star, which was the continuation of that drama, Shirley, of course, was going to reprise her role as Aurora, and she said, "Hey, would you like to write it?" And I said, "Well, sure," and I wrote it for her. And then when the studio was looking for directors, they talked to many, many people, and then Shirley stepped up and said, "You know what? Why don't we let Bobby have a shot at directing this, because he's written it, he understands the material, he understands the world." And so that was kind of that. I mean, I did have to jump through some hoops and prove myself, and I did.
Wow! I mean, it is pretty amazing. This isn't even like an indie feature. This is a major Hollywood film. And she went back for you, and you did.
Direct Jack Nicholson and Juliette Lewis.
Exactly.
So, yeah, it was a major thing.
Now, the bad news, of course, is that Evening Star was not particularly well received. It didn't do too well, and the reviews weren't so great. But do you know that when you've wrapped up a film, do you have a sense of whether it'll be well received, badly received, do you not really know until all the reviews come out and a week's gone by and the grosses don't go up?
You really never know. I think that we loved it. We were proud of it. We still are proud of it. All sorts of things come into play in those situations. I mean, it was such an amazingly honored and treasured original film, Terms of Endearment. I mean, sometimes people just don't want to see a continuation of that. I mean, sometimes that's just the situation.
You don't need to kill a mockingbird,
people,
too.
Sometimes they just don't. They don't think it should be done or whatever, but it was not. I mean, Larry wrote the book. He continued the story.
Sure.
So it was just an attempt to continue the story, and we loved it, and, we're proud of it.
And are you still friends with Shirley MacLaine?
Oh, yeah.
Wonderful.
I heard yesterday.
I interviewed her a couple of months ago now, but interesting lady. Seems like a character out of Steel Magnolias. Definitely. I mean, she was in the film, but you know what I'm saying, I think.
Well, Shirley's fantastic. She's a character out of this world, not just out of Steel Magnolias. No, she's completely amazing and totally one of the most vibrant and talented people I've ever met.
And then you also did another film called Laws of Attraction. That was kind of a romantic comedy.
Mm-hmm. And that was a rewrite. Yeah. That had been in process, and producers.
Mm-hmm.
The producers, offered me the chance to rewrite that, and I did. And I love Julianne Moore, and it was a chance to work. That's the thing that I really get most excited about, is the opportunity to write for people that I just, kind of worship and think, because you create a character, you give this incredibly talented person, and Pierce as well, and give them fun things to do, and then they take that ball and run with it, and it's such a joy to be a part of. That's what attracts me more to material than anything, is the chance to work with the actor.
And by the way, when you say Pierce, you're talking about Pierce Brosnan,
Pierce
in case people haven't seen the film. Now, and also speaking of very famous actors in or near Robert Harling's work, we do have to get to that whole casting of Steel Magnolias, and everybody who was anybody wanted to be in it, including apparently, I mean, I'm getting some of my info, I guess, from Wikipedia and such, but was Liz Taylor interesting at one point?
Absolutely, yeah.
Did you talk to her? Did you meet her? Or she just sent overtures through her agent?
No, I did meet Ms. Taylor. I had had tea earlier, about a month before she came to see the show in New York, with Betty Davis. And Betty Davis had mentioned to Elizabeth Taylor, I wish I could do a better Betty Davis impersonation. There's a role for you, Elizabeth. And so Ms. Taylor came to see the play, and it was such a sensation when she showed up and word had gotten out that she was coming. There were so many people there to see her go to the theater, walk into the theater, that they had to shut down the street. So so she came to see it, and you always, this was my, I was very young, very wet behind the ears, and you know, very, this is my first thing I'd ever written. And I realized she's going to be sitting in the audience when an actress on stage says, when it comes to suffering, she's right up there with Elizabeth Taylor. And I went, think about those things. You don't think about those things when you're just writing this little thing and
sure,
no idea if it's even going to be produced. And then so I was holding my breath and I was watching her, and she laughed her head off.
Oh, thank goodness. Yeah, I mean,
yeah.
If she hadn't, that would have been a very interesting evening right there. How do you, so here's the question. I mean, when you're in that position of, well, I guess you weren't the casting director or the director of Steel Magnolias, but how do you say no to Elizabeth Taylor when she wants to, you know, don't, it's amazing that a star like that doesn't just say, okay, I want to play so-and-so, and the studio says, she's playing so-and-so.
As the writer, I would really at that point never have been in that position. It's not so much that you say no, it's just that it just won't work out, or she's not available, or we're going another way. It's not like, oh no, you can't do it. It's more that I think it was more of a scheduling situation, and probably a, you know, something about, you know, some people, there are actors you could say yes, great, and you're going to go film in Louisiana in July, August, and September, and there's scenes that take place in winter, and you're going to have to wear sweaters and overcoats, and they'll go, nope, not interested.
Well, can I ask why, first of all, how did you end up meeting and becoming friends with Betty Davis, and whether she was interested in a role, and did that work out and stuff?
Well, that's kind of a long story. I'm glad we have a few minutes.
Sure, sure.
I had just written a play. It was catching on, you know, critics, everything was going, you know, it was just one of those things, you know, starting to happen. And word had gotten out that there were sixth grade roles for, somebody else's words, not mine, sixth grade roles for women. So I was sitting in my little apartment in New York, and my phone rings, and this voice, once again, I wish I could do a better interpretation. This voice is, Mr. Harling, this is Betty Davis. And I said, oh, Timmy, stop it, I'm busy. Because I had this friend named Timmy who did a wonderful Betty Davis.
Right, well.
And then there was dead silence. And the voice said, excuse me, this is Betty Davis. And I went, oh my God, to myself, Betty Davis. And I said, yes, Miss Davis, this is Rupert Harling. How may I help you? And she said, I hear you've written a wonderful play. I would like you to come to D. And I said, well, okay. So the next day I was scheduled to go to her suite at her hotel. And I had tea with Betty Davis. And I still to this day, I'm sitting here like with little goosebumps thinking about it. To walk in and to have this woman, she fixed the tea. Nobody else was around. She just fixed the tea, and she wanted to talk about acting, and she wanted to talk about film, and she wanted to talk about stuff she wanted to do and the role of Weezer. Mm. And 2 hours 45 10 minutes went by, yeah. And she was talking about everything. She was talking about Now Voyager, and she was talking about Baby Jane, and she was talking about... I could not believe I was sitting there with one of the great icons of the 20th century, just telling me stuff. And at the end, she walked me to the elevator, and I remember being standing inside the elevator, and she's outside the elevator, cigarette in hand. And she said, "Well, Mr. Harling, someone else might possibly pay Weezer, but if they do, you and they will hear from Betty Davis." A bitter door closed.
Whoa. And someone else did, obviously. I mean, how could you... Again...
They wound up. Surely wound up.
Right, but did that put you in a position of, like, being...
No. Like I said, you know, there's so many variables that happen during that situation, and, you know, in that kind of situation, and she was... It was fairly near the end of her life, so...
Well, yeah, that's what I was kind of wondering about, too.
And it was... And once again, once... You know, when agents and managers and you realize... She had not seen the play at that point. And she came a couple of nights later, again, incredible sensation, her showing up at the theater.
Sure.
And you know, I think once she saw the physical demands of the role and all of that, sometimes things just don't work out, and that happens all the time. I mean, there are all those famous stories of people who originally were supposed to do roles and didn't, and then someone else took the role and became, you know, hugely...
Sure. Absolutely. Now, we are talking, by the way, with Robert Harling, invariably about Steel Magnolias, even though he's done all that other stuff. That's the one that just keeps cropping up again and again. And it cropped up just a couple of weeks ago, again, as a remake on the Lifetime Channel Network. What did you think? I did not get to see it, but what did you think of this new version of the material?
I thought the cast was extraordinary, and I thought that the direction was really, really terrific. I think the adaptation into well, I mean, it really wasn't even that much of an adaptation. It's just it really speaks to how the work and the story of my mother and my sister, which it tells their story, is universal. I've seen, I saw a rough cut. I actually didn't see it broadcast on the screen. It's wonderful. It's wonderful actors saying my words. You know, who can argue anything about that? And people say, oh, there was so much attention and people asking what I felt about it. I did not adapt it. I didn't do any of the updating on the script. I didn't, because, you know, if you're going to, the play is like 2 hours and 20 minutes long, and if you're going to do it on television, it has to be like 142 minutes or something like that. And so they, you know, they had to make all sorts of adjustments and edits, and I didn't want to have anything to do with touching my baby. Hmm. So, but I was really thrilled that it was able to be refreshed in this way. And, so, you know, you sit there and you watch, wait a minute, they cut that thing. Well, they had to.
Now let's go back to the writing of Steel Magnolias, because the really staggering thing is you weren't a drama student, you weren't a writing student, you didn't have 10 one-acts in your drawers and 3 failed plays. I mean, you went through a personal experience with your family, and this came out. I mean, I would just love to hear that whole process, that journey.
It was the death of my sister from diabetes,
right.
Who is the character Shelby is based upon her, and the character Malin is based on my mother, and all the other women are women that were in my life at the time, and I was so overwhelmed by the support that this group of women gave each other and their strength. I mean, the men in the family, we were all basket cases. We couldn't even function. But the women just kept doing it and kept it going and kept everything together. And that made such an impression on me. When I wanted to make something some sort of trivia. Somehow it really bothered me that the child that my sister had and that is portrayed as Jackson in the piece and in the film, he's not in the play, the character's not in the play, but in the film, that he would never know. He would grow up completely unaware of how incredibly magnificent and what a wonderful spirit his mother was, and all the things that went on to support them as my sister had this kid. And so I just was really, really torn up about it. And I have a really good friend, Michael Weller, very, very famous.
Playwright, yes.
Yeah, very, very successful playwright. And he and his wife were very good friends of mine. And they kept urging me, his wife especially, Kathy Talbert, kept urging me, write something for him. And I thought, I don't know how to write a play or something. They would just write anything. So I sat down thinking I was going to write sort of a short story which would detail the journey of these women and all of this experience in my life. And I was missing, in writing the prose, I was missing the fun dialogue and the humor and the strength of the language of the area. And so I was an actor, so I know what a play looks like.
Oh, I didn't realize you were an actor. Okay.
Yeah, I was an actor. So I know what a play, I know what it looks like on a page. And so I said, well, I'm just going to write something that makes me feel better at the end, because that was my goal, was to help deal with my own personal pain and loss of my sister, and also to illuminate a little bit of her life. So it only took like 10 days. I mean, it was very, once I decided on the venue, once I decided where it took place, which would be the Beauty Parlor, which was based on my life, because every Saturday all the women would disappear and then reappear with these same sort of football helmet hairdos. It was always a place of mystery to me when I was a kid. So I thought, okay, well, that's where I'll put it. And then I knew the events that happened, and once I decided how each character would be created to interact with one another, I just sat down and wrote it. It didn't take me very long, 10 days. And when it was done, I had no idea what it was. I mean, I just knew that I felt better after I read it back to myself. So I took it to a receptionist at a literary agency, and who's a friend, and I said, "Does this look like a play?" And she said, "Yeah, looks like a play to me." And so the agent there sent it off, and she actually sent it to I can't remember. It was like 20. Well, it's 25 years ago. I can't remember exactly the circumstances, but she had submitted it to a playwriting contest, but it was a playwriting contest for women playwrights, and she had put like B. Harling, and they wanted to do it. It was, and she had to then say, "Oh, sorry, B stands for Bob, not for Betty." But I thought that was a wonderful edification or validation that it seemed like the voices were correct. And anyway, so then we went on, and it had its subsequent production at the WPA Theater, and then moved to the commercial run, and then became a movie, and then.
And how much, can I ask?
What it is?
But when you put the end, or curtain, or end of play on the end of that first draft, that first script, how different was it from the production that then went to the WPA and then into, the commercial off-Broadway production? I mean, were there a lot of further drafts? Was there a lot of tinkering? Or was it like 90 to 95% exactly the same?
That would be an interesting thing to go back and look at, because I still have it. I have the actual first typed, hand-typed thing. And look at what now exists with Dramatist Play Service. I've never done that, never looked at the two side by side. But I think generally I'd have to classify it more as tinkering. We had this brilliant director, Pamela Berlin, and when we went into rehearsal, it was more a situation of the language and the words. Those are all the words of the characters and the people. I mean, that's exactly that's what they said. So a lot of that has remained pretty much the same during
if your director had been Robert Wilson, he would have said, you'll need 3 minutes at least to probably watch it in slow motion. You know, I want to see suds.
So that was, it was more, I would say the text was really remained pretty true during the whole process. But moving things around and inventing new conversations, so just to let stage time be doable.
And my question also is, after the pretty much immediate success of Steel Magnolias, I guess, were you then snapped up by Hollywood, which is why you didn't do more theater?
I'm kind of like I'm a play rote, sort of. I mean, I've always wanted to do more theater, but I have all these really great friends who are just so brilliant and so fantastic and just burning with ideas. Tony Kushner and Doug Wright and Craig Lucas, and they express themselves. I didn't set out to be a playwright. I didn't set out to be a writer. I set out to do something so this kid would know who his mama was. So it's not like that. Oh yes, playwriting is something I must do. That wasn't in the cards.
You were in theater on some, or I guess in film and TV, because you dropped law to go into acting.
Yeah.
So. Yes. There was some level of showbiz in you. What did you do as an actor?
One of the things during the early process of Steel Magnolias was I was thinking, great, now I can write a role for me to act. I realized that was not what I wanted to be doing. So I just, it's nothing more, it's not that, it's kind of a hard question to answer because I never started out to be a playwright, and it was like, oh, so that's what it's like to do a play. Oh, so that's what it's like to do a movie. And it just seems like that's just the path I followed, because I didn't have lots of stories to tell on stage.
Hmm. No, that's cool. And basically the things that you've done in movies have been other people's ideas that you've been asked to work on.
Soapdish came about because I remember I said that we would all get together while we were filming Steel Magnolias and have potluck suppers and stuff. And we would do that every night, and we would play games and charades and all that sort of thing just every night. Right. And one night we were doing kind of a question game, and I asked all the actresses, what's the one role you've always wanted to play but never got a chance to play? And Shirley said, well, I've never played an alcoholic. Well, then she's done Postcards from the Edge and other things. And Daryl said, well, I only want to do really strong women that really make a difference, but I'll never play a prostitute. And of course, she's played several. Julia said, hey, I just got here, I'll do anything. Olympia wanted to do, I don't know, Brecht and some, anyway, really meaty theater. Dolly said, well, Madea, of course. And then when we got Sally said, I always play really, really noble characters that wear, like, jeans and T-shirts, or really poor people with, that wear kind of raggy places in the heart.
Normal ray, sure, yeah.
She said, I never get a chance to really look nice. For once, I'd like to play a bitch that wears nice clothes. So I thought, that stuck with me. And so I started thinking, okay, well, what if someone who's perceived as America's sweetheart, who Sally was at the time, and what if she is really actually a bitch with teeth who's ruined the lives of everybody around her, like a soap opera star? Because as an actor, I knew something about soap operas because I had been on a couple, and my roommate for several years was a soap actor. So I'd been around that world. So they say, write what you know, and this was the second crack out of the box, and I thought, okay, the world of soap opera, America's sweetheart, who really has lots of secrets and whose life is even more absurd than the role she plays in the soap opera. And that's how Soap Dish was created. So that's,
yeah,
that's, well, kind of how that happened. And, you know, and to try to get back to the theater, because I really would love to, turning it into a musical.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. Who's the composer lyricist on that?
George Stiles and Anthony Drew. They're two incredibly talented guys. They're English. They did the new version of Mary Poppins. It's playing on Broadway right now. They've had much success in England, and they've done a wonderful, wonderful job of taking and musicalizing this crazy world of soap opera for the stage. We just did a reading of it in sort of a workshop-y reading, backers audition-y thing in New York last month. Kristen Chenoweth. Celeste Talbert role, and John Stamos did the Kevin Kline role. Jane Krakowski did the Kathy Moriarty role. So it was quite something.
A bet. And do you have nibbles? I mean, what's the next step now?
Yeah. No, and that was sort of the kickoff. Now the next step is what you do with those things. You workshop and you learn from that. You learn from that. From that audience reaction, you take that feedback and you work on it. That's kind of the way it happens with musicals, as you know.
Sure, absolutely. We are, by the way, talking with Robert Harling. We have just a couple more minutes. Are you still free for a couple of minutes?
Oh, gosh, it's going fast.
It sure is, but I'm having a marvelous time with the author. By the way, well, I do want to say, yes, he wrote the scripts for Soap Dish and the First Wives Club and the Laws of Attraction, but let's also be mindful of not only the 25th anniversary of Steel Magnolias, but that there's going to be a 25th anniversary reading of the play. I should have mentioned this earlier. I apologize for not bringing it up until now. But on December 3rd at the Lucille Lortel Theater off-Broadway, it's a celebrity staged reading of Steel Magnolias featuring Blythe Danner, Maren Mazzi, Annie Potts, Margot Martindale, which is really exciting because she was in the original one. She was playing Truby back then. Now she's going to be playing the mother, Malin. Celia Keenan Bolger is in it. She's a big rising star in Broadway and off-Broadway theaters. I think she's still in Peter and the Starcatcher as we speak. And Judith Ivey is directing, and all the proceeds are going to benefit juvenile diabetes, of course. So kind of way, way cool. And then the people, by the way, who are on the board of this reading are all the folks from the movie of Steel Magnolias. Am I right about that?
That's right. Julia, Sally, Olympia, Shirley, Polly.
Yeah. Were any of them approached about doing the reading, or you didn't have any ideas about that?
Well, I don't think they would have wanted to. They've already sort of done it. You know what I mean? They put their stamp on the role, and they've been so fabulous and supportive and generous with their their acknowledgement of it. I mean, that we were thrilled and very honored and humbled that they would want to be on the honorary committee. But it's incredibly exciting, and like you say, for me, as 25 years have gone by, I get this constant. The play's been done everywhere. I mean, Japan. I mean, it's dozens of languages and all of that. And what seems to be happening now is some of the actresses who played the younger generations of Annelle or Shelby are now in productions where they're playing Malin and Truby, and some of the Malins and Trubys have written me and said, now I'm playing Weezer and Clary. Life goes on. It's just a very, very exciting thing for someone who's written roles for women, that to see they keep giving back to the women. That's just very, very humbling. And Margot, I'm so excited about Margot. I wrote the role of Trudy for her originally, and now she's coming back and playing Weezer, which is
she's playing Weezer or Malin. Sorry.
I'm sorry. What?
Is she playing Weezer or Malin?
Margot Martin. Martindale?
Yeah.
Oh, she's playing Weezer.
Oh, I'm sorry. I had that wrong. But, no, she's playing Weezer. Great. Mm-hmm. Even better. So cool. So quite a cast, by the way, being assembled for December 3rd at the Lucia Lortel Theater. Let me just also give the email, the website for that is steelmagnolias-. I can't tell if that's a dash or an underscore, but I believe it's a dash, 25years.org. steelmagnolias-25years.org. If that's not a dash, it's an underscore. It's pretty easy to find either way. But do, folks, check that out. And also, creator and producer on this is Kristen Chenoweth. Her name is attached to this. And I wanted to ask about GCB, which is the TV show you were involved with for the past couple of years that starred Kristen Chenoweth, and wondering how that came about, etc., and so forth.
Well, it was there was a book, again, written by Kim Gatlin, who is this great, fabulous, larger-than-life Dallas socialite who chronicled some stories that she had experienced and friends had experienced about a woman who comes back and has to deal with the hypocrisy and some of the less Christian side of religion sometimes.
Okay.
When people are not as giving and as kind as they should be. And so she wrote this book, and ABC thought it would make a terrific series, and so it was purchased. Well, I guess the rights were gotten by the very prolific and very celebrated Darren Star, who created Sex and the City, and we decided to create this TV series, and we did, and it lasted a year, and we loved it. We were very proud of it. It was very, very controversial, which is...
I wanted to ask you about that, you know, because before you could even get the show off the ground or on the air, you know, the right-wing groups and the Christian groups heard about the title. GCB stood for, was it Good Christian Bitches? Something like that? Right, good credit. So, I mean, was there ever a thought to say, you know what, let's just get this thing on the... We'll change the title, and we won't have nearly the problems that they're giving us just to even get this on the air and get past controversy over three words. Or, you know, because I know Chenoweth stood firm and said, no, that's the title, you know, I'm standing by it, why don't you? But what was the whole thing about that?
Well, again, a lot of those things take place, especially in television, take place in rooms far away from mine.
Yeah.
I'm busy writing and shooting. So, I initially thought there were many things that it could have been called, I think, but they decided to stick with, well, actually they didn't stick with the title. They couldn't have possibly have stuck with the title. Because even now, today, there's a show called Don't Trust the Bee in Apartment 23, but on the same network, because there's just, in this country, there's just too much resistance to that.
Even though William Shatner had no problem being in a TV show called Shit My Father Says. Honest to gosh, that was the time they bleeped it out or whatever they did. But nobody had a problem. Maybe because it's Shatner. But I'm sorry, continue.
Well, no, but it was funny because we would have these international meetings, and Australia came. They were thrilled about it. They absolutely loved the show. They'd seen the pilot. They bought it, and they called it Good Christian Bitches, and I said, really, you're going to call it that? And they said, what else would you call it? I think it was a real shame because nothing about the TV show whatsoever indicted Christianity, made fun of it, or anything like that. It made fun of people who are hypocritical. That's what it made fun of. And didn't even make fun of it. I mean, the characters, I believe, were all very human and very understandable, and of course had flaws, which makes people interesting. I think the flaws are what make people interesting. If everybody was perfect, they wouldn't be interesting. So I think that it was it didn't really get a chance because it was attacked too soon before it had a chance to sort of people had a chance to find it and understand it. But once again, you do these things, you're proud of them, you love them, you're glad you did them, and the relationships that grow out of it. I mean, Kristen's one of my dearest friends now. I mean, and all the other cast and crew. It was a wonderful experience. I just wish it had had more of a chance to be found.
Now, it's been a wonderful experience chatting with Robert Harling. I'm going to ask, besides Soap Dish the musical, what are you working on currently that you can talk about?
That I can talk about.
Well, you know, some writers are like, they're in the middle of something. It jinxes it. I'm like that. I want to talk about anything until I have the end.
I'm definitely like that.
Yeah.
The one thing I am doing, there was a really fabulous small independent film released by Focus Features called Miss Pettigrew Lives for a Day. And I became obsessed with, so I was the first person at the first showing on the Friday when it opened in Los Angeles about 5 years ago. And I said, this is a musical, a stage musical for Broadway. And I said, I'm going to make this, I want to do this. So it's taken like 5 years to put the team together and get the rights and all of that. And so it was a wonderful film. Had Frances McDormand, Lee Pace, Mark Strong, Amy Adams, and I fell in love with it. And so we've put a team together. We have Lisa Lambert and Greg Morrison doing music and lyrics. They won a Tony for Drowsy Chaperone.
Oh wow! Cool. Yeah.
Oh, so it's just a thrill to be able to work with people like that. And we're in the. That's actually. One of my main things right now, and I have to go back to New York tomorrow to have a very long, involved work session on it. So that's the first thing. That's up next. I mean, there's a book I've optioned, and you know all that stuff that I'm thinking of pursuing after that. But that's kind of that.
Well, that's pretty darn good. And can I ask, what's your personal life at this point? Do you have a partner, a person, pets? What you got?
Yeah, I have two dogs named Jet and Titan.
Jet and Titan, okay.
And Titan. They're German shepherds and they're staring at me right now. I think they're hungry.
Well, you know, the Titans did become the New York Jets, so there is a connection there.
But
what about, as far as, I know it's none of my business, but we always make these things our business, dating humans, anything like that? Any romance in there somewhere?
No, I don't. That's not. I am surprisingly undercommitted these days.
Surprisingly under? I've never heard that phrase before. Well, were you in a long-term relationship for a while, you know, a while ago, something like that?
No, that's not. I don't find it that interesting, so, you know.
Fair enough, but you do have your dogs, so that's the most important thing, is that you've got your dogs, and even more important is that you've been on this show and such a delight to talk to. And most important of all, December 3rd at the Lucille Ortel Theater, they're doing a reading of the 25-year-old Steel Magnolias with people like Blythe Danner and Maren Mazzi, Margot Martindale, who was in the original off-Broadway production, Celia Keenan-Bolger, and more. Do check that out. It's steelmagnolias-25years.org for more information about that. And remember, all the proceeds do go to the Juvenile Diabetes Foundation. Anyway, Robert Harling, it has been, as I said, really a pleasure to talk to you about all the stuff you've done and are doing, and I certainly wish you great luck on Soap Dish and on all the other stuff, all the musicals that are coming in your life and the novel you've optioned, whatever it is. I wish you great success with it.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a great time.